The minute he's in office, he starts hemming and hawing and talking about the fact that, you know, oh, well, do we want to cancel the debts for lawyers and doctors? So I think he's got to, you know, in addition to his financial ties, he doesn't understand, you know, who actually is pursuing higher education in this country, who is burdened by debt, the fact that 40% of student debtors don't even have a college degree.
We want to thank Esther Taylor for being with us, co-director of the Debt Collective. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Matt Ely. We have an immediate jobs opening for a news writer producer. Go to democracynow.org for information. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report on what Portland police did during the massive protests of 2020. An historic appointment, the first African-American woman wins her place on the U.S. Supreme Court. And a dangerous virus affecting oysters in Oregon, Washington, California, and other states. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 7, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. A Portland police surveillance report is revealing a lot about what happened during the protests that rocked the city for months. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the story.
Information regarding how Portland police collected information on protesters during 2020's racial justice demonstrations was released in a report on Wednesday. The audit from City Auditor Mary Holt Caballero's office examined how the Bureau gathered intelligence and conducted criminal investigations during the civil unrest of the near-nightly demonstrations. Data collected from the report show that the PPB gave no guidance to officers on what information they could collect on protesters, leaving officers using their own discretion. Other findings reveal that the Criminal Intelligence Unit did not limit access to its reports and kept them accessible past their retention schedule. At least five cases demonstrate where officers collected pictures and public social media posts without documenting suspected criminal activity, which could be considered an attempt to stifle free speech. Auditors also addressed two concerns of many civil rights groups where the police plain and properly surveilled protesters. Additional information collected found that the Bureau held information about political activity without safeguards, protesters' personal information was collected by officers without documenting reasons, Bureau technology gathered personal information without policies and procedures to protect civil rights, and that officers used social media for investigative purposes without direction. The report concluded that better transparency may have lowered the public's fear of airplane surveillance. Recommendations from the report include four relating to the updating of policies, guidelines, and directives on surveillance, social media use and technology, and one advising the Bureau to release a public report on its use of surveillance technology. Police Chief Chuck Lavelle said the Bureau was in full agreement with three of the recommendations and partially agreed with the other two, and that both past policies under review as well as current policies would be examined to address the audit's concerns and help assure accountability and build trust for the community. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
The FDA announced on Wednesday that it's working with federal and local authorities on a recent multi-state norovirus outbreak linked to raw oysters. The contaminated oysters were harvested in the south and central parts of Bain Sound, British Columbia, and were distributed to restaurants and businesses in states including Oregon, Washington, and California, among others. The FDA says it's working with state agencies to fully determine where the oysters were distributed and on removing them from the food supply. Officials from the FDA issued warnings that retailers should not serve raw oysters from the British Columbia harvest locations BC-14-8 and BC-14-15 with harvest dates starting as early as January 31st of 2022. All the harvest information is printed on product tags. People of all ages can get infected and sick with norovirus, particularly those with certain food sensitivities and those with compromised immune systems. Symptoms of infection include most commonly severe diarrhea, vomiting, nausea, and stomach pain. Other symptoms can include fever, chills, headaches, and body aches. A person infected with norovirus will generally develop symptoms within 12 to 48 hours after exposure, with people recovering generally in 2 to 3 days. People infected run high risk of dehydration due to constant diarrhea and vomiting, especially young children, older adults, and those with other ongoing illnesses. If you or someone near you thinks they may have been exposed to norovirus, the FDA urges them to contact a medical professional. You can find more information on norovirus symptoms and prevention on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC's, website. It's an historic day as the U.S. Senate votes to confirm the first black woman to be appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson will become the 116th Supreme Court Justice. She was confirmed today by a vote in the United States Senate. The vote included 53 yeas and 47 nays. Three Republican senators crossed party lines and voted for her: Senators Mitch Romney of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. All 50 Democrats voted in her favor. Jackson will be the first black woman ever to sit on the court, fulfilling a promise Joe Biden made during his 2020 presidential campaign. Kamala Harris, the first black woman to serve as vice president, presided over the chamber during the historic vote in her capacity as president of the Senate. Jackson will be sworn in as an associate justice after Justice Stephen Breyer retires at the end of the court's term, which is expected sometime this summer. The confirmation and her appointment are not expected to change the ideologic balance of the court. Biden, Harris, and Jackson will make an address tomorrow from the South Lawn of the White House. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Senate Majority Leader, said, quote, "Even in the darkest times, there are bright lights. Today is one of the brightest lights. Let us hope it's a metaphor, an indication of many bright lights to come," end quote. Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, turned his back and walked out of the chamber following the confirmation, as did most remaining Republicans. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
After a tough couple of years of the pandemic, what should Oregonians look for in their next governor? And what questions should we ask of the candidates who want the job? I asked that of experts at Oregon State University, Professors Courtney Campbell, Chumwei Chi, and Chris Nichols. Here's how they responded.
Obviously, in philosophy, we have a really mixed relationship with philosopher kings and giving advice to politicians. But a couple of things that I think are important to at least follow through but need to be developed further. One is to, Kate Brown, the Oregon Health Authority, put together a vaccine advisory commission to address certain issues about allocation and health equity. That seems to me absolutely critical, especially in the state of Oregon, where the most recent data from the Oregon Health Authority says that the Hispanic population in Oregon is still at 55% vaccination. So we have got a real challenge in the state of Oregon to address issues of health equity. And I would like you to ask them how they plan to follow that out. I think that's absolutely critical. I think that the other kind of issue that needs to be addressed is something we've already kind of discussed. How my sense is, Annette, I don't know if I spoke to you about this or someone else, but most states have some kind of independent task force, state task force, on issues pertaining to life and the law. Oregon doesn't have that. Those task forces are put together by community members, some professionals, some people like myself and so forth, and others. It's very diverse. We don't have that. And it seems to me that we're at a state in both the pandemic and with respect to other kinds of health issues, including health equity, where it'd be very valuable to have a commission, a task force that sort of follows what's been done very effectively in other states. And so that would be I don't want to endorse by any means kind of a top-down approach. That is, that those task forces are often bottom-up deliberation forums for the community members to inform public policy. But I think we need something like that. And I, again, that'd be another kind of recommendation or question to ask to the governor candidates.
How about you, Professor Chi? What do you think?
Well, whoever becomes the new governor will have a huge task on his or her shoulder. Prior to the pandemic, every health and social problem or issue we had just got exacerbated by this pandemic. And so I think whoever becomes the new governor will have a huge task to assess those issues, including health inequity and social inequity, everything. And it's not just the United States. I have students done group project on other countries. And this seems to be global, that every country have the same challenges, same issue. Whatever problem already existed just become worse. And this is also another important reason we need to end this pandemic soon, because every month it lingers on, those problems just got worse. And the other issue would be, hope the new governor will take the lesson very hard to prepare us from getting into another pandemic, especially getting into, well, the pandemic is not a state can prevent, but at least we should be able to get it one. Hope it never happened, but if it happened, hope we will be much better prepared for the next pandemic, because there's a lot of public health infrastructure underdeveloped and very unequally across the state.
I have a quick response there as well. I think Chinwe just described it well, but there's sort of two historical lessons I would suggest for what the governors will face. One is that following 1918 and 19, for instance, most states and counties tried to begin to equip themselves with a toolkit to deal with a next pandemic or a next surge. And most of them failed, particularly in the U.S. And the U.S. federal government also didn't strengthen its public health service. So coming out of this, whatever the next stages of this pandemic or endemic stage are, I think it's incumbent on leaders in American politics to do some really reflective self-searching about what failed and what succeeded, and to generate a kind of new system, the sorts of things that other experts have been describing here, to grapple with those. And then the second level element there is that pandemics in human history have exposed the fractures and fissures in society. And yet very often there's a kind of amnesia about those deadly infectious diseases that sets in quite rapidly after them. Not that people forget and not that the suffering doesn't go away, but in terms of public policy, it very often does. And so, you know, I would want the governors to think, governor candidates to think deeply about what's been exposed and then how they intend to deal with it. What are practical, actionable items that they would bring into office right away while the memory is still fresh, while we're still dealing with hospitals that are full.
And those are the comments of Oregon State University professors Courtney Campbell, Chinwe Chi, and Chris Nichols. The Rose Festival's Grand Floral Parade will be back in person this summer after almost 3 years of absences due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A large distinction in 2022's parade is the route will not include downtown Portland. This will be the first time since 1961 that the annual Grand Floral Parade will not use downtown as its showcase. Rose Festival organizers say that despite the Grand Floral Parade being held this year on the east side of the Willamette, people can still enjoy the annual Starlight Parade downtown on the west side. Besides ensuring that more people will be able to have access to a parade, the spreading out will help the organization's staffing and resources, which have diminished since the onset of the pandemic. Rose Festival Chief Operating Officer Marilyn Clint said, quote, "The special events industry is no different than any other business that relies on both human resources and economic resources. The business of making a comeback is serious and it's challenging." The Grand Floral Parade's route will start inside the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, then go outside into Northeast Wheeler Street before turning east on Lloyd Boulevard by the Banfield Freeway and end near the Lloyd Center. Clint says this is likely a one-time change for the parade, but agrees with city officials that it will help provide the viewing public with better distribution of available public safety resources and will hopefully increase participation and accessibility for residents and attendees across the city. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on how the Clean Water Act has fallen short of its full promise 50 years later. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, cloudy. Occasional showers overnight, a low down to 49. Tomorrow's weather, intervals of clouds and sun, high 54. We're looking at a good chance of rain over the weekend with highs near 50. Today in history, President Dwight D. Eisenhower coined one of the most famous Cold War phrases on this date in 1954, suggesting a falling domino principle would apply to communist countries. The quote of the day is from Eisenhower, who said, "You have a row of dominoes set up. You knock over the first one, and what will happen to the last one is the certainty that it will go over very quickly. So you could have a beginning of a disintegration that would have the most profound influences." Taxpayer subsidies to the fossil fuel industry have been used to fund disinformation campaigns on climate and lobbying efforts to stall transitioning to clean energy sources. But the latest climate warning by leading global scientists includes a silver lining. The technologies exist to avoid the worst-case scenarios. The new UN Environmental Panel on Climate Change report says the biggest barrier to reducing greenhouse gas emissions to safe levels is a lack of political will. Eric Alatis has more on the story.
Burning fossil fuels at current rates is expected to produce mass extinctions and other catastrophic outcomes, but a brighter future is possible if large-scale action is taken within the next 3 years, according to the latest warning by leading climate scientists. Greg Findlay is a lander-based climate instructor at the online school Terra.do. He says Wyoming is in a great position to build out clean energy infrastructure.
You can't outsource jobs installing solar and wind and building transmission lines. Those are jobs that could go to local people and could have a real impact on the economy and the workers here in the state of Wyoming.
The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report says greenhouse gas emissions must reach peak levels within 3 years and then decline by at least 50% by 2030 in order to keep temperatures from rising to dangerous levels. The dire warning comes with an upside. The technologies and tools to get the job done exist today. Findlay says the report's recommendations land squarely on burning fossil fuels, not on Wyoming's agricultural sector, including livestock production. Wyoming currently produces about 40% of the nation's coal. To avoid worst-case scenarios, scientists say coal emissions must be reduced by 95% by 2050.
We could view that as a horrible thing for Wyoming, or we could view that as an opportunity to transition now so that we don't end up with stranded assets and stranded workers.
Despite efforts by the fossil fuel industry to polarize and confuse the public, Findlay says many people understand that this is not a niche environmental issue. He says ensuring that future generations have a livable planet is actually a conservative position and one that should resonate with anyone who has worked hard for their kids to have better lives.
And if we don't take action on climate change, they are guaranteed to have worse, more challenging, more difficult lives than we currently do. And when we have the solutions today, and they're not even all that expensive to implement, we really ought to do something to take care of the future for our kids.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A House panel grills oil companies over high gas prices. Congressional stock trades go under the microscope. Russia faces new sanctions. And Texas plans to reroute migrants from the border to Washington, D.C. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There's nothing wrong with making an honest profit, but as gas prices have soared, your companies have funneled record profits back to shareholders.
Oil executives were in the hot seat as a House subcommittee accused companies of price gouging. Committee Chair Congressman Frank Polloni questioned why pump prices remain high while crude oil prices have been dropping for weeks. ExxonMobil Chairman and CEO Darren Wood countered, no single company sets prices.
The market establishes the price based on available supply and the demand for that supply. Continued investments in new production is the only way to achieve balanced markets and more affordable prices that bring real relief at the pump.
While most at the hearing acknowledged the Russian-Ukraine conflict's effect on fuel prices, Democrats scolded executives for sitting on thousands of leases to drill on public lands, artificially squeezing supply. Congressman Morgan Griffith, the highest-ranking Republican on the panel, blamed the White House.
When President Biden points to Vladimir Putin or Big Oil or other scapegoats as the culprit, I'm reminded of the words of the Wizard of Oz. Pay no attention to that man standing behind the curtain.
The six companies at the hearing recorded $77 billion in profits in 2021. In response to Russia's alleged war crimes in Ukraine, President Biden announced a new round of sanctions targeting President Vladimir Putin's inner circle, including his daughters and more financial institutions. Three dozen former members of Congress are asking lawmakers to ban themselves from trading individual stocks while in office. A House panel will hold a hearing today after reports emerged dozens of members of Congress have violated conflict of interest laws. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer applauded a White House extension through August of the pause on federal student loan payment collections, which began at the start of the pandemic.
Of course, I believe the president should go further and forgive $50,000 in student loans permanently. It's a huge burden on so many people.
The House voted to hold two of President Trump's advisors in contempt for defying subpoenas from the January 6th committee. Peter Navarro and Dan Scavino both refused to testify, claiming executive privilege. Meanwhile, a New Mexico man was acquitted of misdemeanor charges for entering the Capitol building that day. A federal judge said the defendant's actions were minimal and non-serious. It's the first acquittal of a January 6th defendant. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has a new plan to tackle the influx of undocumented immigrants he says are overwhelming local communities. Charter buses.
We are sending them to the United States Capitol, where the Biden administration will be able to more immediately address the needs of the people that they are allowing to come across our border.
The move comes in response to the end of Title 42 restrictions, which prevented migrants from crossing the border during the pandemic. There are reportedly 1.7 million undocumented immigrants in Texas. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Marijuana may be legal in another state soon. Maryland voters will have the opportunity to decide whether to legalize adult-use recreational cannabis in November. The state's General Assembly passed a bill to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, as Lily Bulkey reports.
Groups are raising awareness about a ballot initiative in Maryland to legalize adult-use recreational cannabis. The state House and Senate voted last week to pass House Bill 1, which put a constitutional amendment for adult-use cannabis on the November ballot. They also passed House Bill 837, outlining policies if voters approve the measure, legalizing possession of up to 1.5 ounces of marijuana and up to 2 marijuana plants for personal use. Olivia Noggle with the Marijuana Policy Project notes it also would expunge marijuana convictions and allow those in prison for it to file for resentencing.
Cannabis prohibition is a failed policy, and I think voters recognize that. Polling has consistently shown that a majority of Marylanders support legalizing cannabis for adults. So I'm really happy that they're going to finally have their voices heard on the ballot in November.
Opponents say marijuana is a dangerous drug that should not be encouraged, although studies have shown it can be regulated safely. And the latest polling from Goucher College shows more than 60% of Marylanders support legalization. Noggle notes that HB 837 does not set up a regulatory framework for an adult-use cannabis industry in the state. She says that would have to be taken up next legislative session. Noggle adds that under Maryland's current cannabis laws, every year thousands of residents, disproportionately Black residents, are arrested and receive a criminal conviction for cannabis possession. She adds that the expungement process is key as well for people who have previous convictions.
We know a criminal record can make it difficult to obtain housing, employment, and other public benefits. So cannabis policy reform, it'll begin to reduce criminalization for cannabis and all of these collateral consequences that come with a criminal conviction.
If the ballot initiative passes in November, Maryland will join 18 states plus Washington, D.C. with recreationally legal cannabis. In 2020, voters in Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota all approved ballot measures to legalize marijuana, although South Dakota's policy has been challenged in court. This is Lily Wolke with Maryland News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Blackfeet Tribal Court releases the names of those arrested in a drug raid. A Montana court blocks two laws passed to protect Native voting rights. Alaska tribes back Judge Brown Jackson for the Supreme Court. And a Native Hall of Fame will create an exhibit at Oklahoma's First Americans Museum. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Blackfeet Tribal Court has released the names of 9 people who were recently arrested on drug charges at the home of the Blackfeet Nation tribal chairman. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the arrest came after the Blackfeet Nation declared a state of emergency following a series of fentanyl overdoses and deaths.
The Blackfeet Tribal Court's chief justice initially sealed the case following the arrest last week. The court and assistant U.S. attorney for the Blackfeet tribe, Josh Lampson, unsealed the case, releasing the names of the 9 individuals arrested at the home of Blackfeet Tribal Business Council Chairman Timothy Davis. 6 of those arrested share the Davis last name. Charges range from criminal sale and possession of dangerous drugs to child endangerment. Chairman Davis was not home when law enforcement searched his residence and has not been arrested. In a text message to MTPR, he said, quote, "This terrible miscarriage of justice is a sham and was fake news and a political witch hunt against me and my family," end quote. All 8 who were charged pleaded not guilty. A pretrial date has been set for later this month. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A Montana court blocked 2 state laws Wednesday that advocates say hinder Native American voting rights. One measure would have ended Election Day registration, which Native voters rely on to cast votes. The second measure would have blocked paid ballot collection. Native voters on rural reservations often rely on the service of ballot collectors. The Montana 13th Judicial District Court of Yellowstone County granted the preliminary injunction. The challenge to the laws was brought by the Native American Rights Fund, the ACLU of Montana, the American Civil Liberties Union, and Harvard Law School's Election Law Clinic on behalf of 2 Native vote organizations and 4 tribes. A number of Alaska tribes are backing U.S. Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. One of the tribes is Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. President Chaw Thalish Richard Peterson says that while she does not have the most experience in Indian country law, Jackson is by far the most qualified candidate nominated to the Supreme Court in recent years.
So I think her given aptitude for it is a plus for us. You know, we want people to adjudicate on the letter of the law, and we think the letter of the law favors a lot of the tribal cases.
Other tribes and tribal organizations across Alaska have sent letters of support to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, including the Association of Village Council Presidents, which represents 56 tribes in western Alaska. The letter states that her record of fairness makes her a good choice for the Supreme Court. Jackson also has support from Kuwerik Heidelberg Cooperative Association, Craig Tribal Association, Native Village of Iak, Akiak Native Community, Norvik Native Community, and Tanana Chiefs Conference. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski says she'll support Jackson's nomination. Jackson is expected to be confirmed Thursday, becoming the first Black woman to serve on the nation's highest court. The National Native American Hall of Fame announced Wednesday it received a grant to create an exhibit at the First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City. Interviews of inductees will be used in an oral history exhibit. Part of the Hall of Fame's mission is to educate the public about contemporary Native Americans by sharing their stories. The exhibit is expected to open in November. The award is from the Association of Tribal Archives, Libraries, and Museums. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 7, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Mike Moen, Eric Galatis, and Lily Bolke. The producer is Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's been 50 years since the landmark environmental law, the Clean Water Act, was passed in 1972. It was an ambitious piece of legislation, and it made a real difference in some of the most polluted rivers and waterways in the U.S. But a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project shows that half a century later, the promises of the Clean Water Act have only been half kept. Their research ranked Oregon as number two in the U.S. for the most miles of rivers and waterways that aren't safe for swimming and other kinds of recreation. I spoke with Eric Schaefer, one of the report's co-authors, to learn more about their findings. So yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. The Environmental Integrity Project has just released this report that shows that about half of the rivers, lakes, and reservoirs in the United States are still not safe for swimming, fishing, and recreation, which is, of course, contrary to what the Clean Water Act of 1972 would have.